Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 17% of Massachusetts voters already have cast ballots in the general election. Early voting began Saturday, and with exactly 2 weeks to go until the November election, holy cow, 2 weeks, the pace of early ballots in person and by mail seems unlikely to slow. Can we manage it? And when will all those votes get counted? Let's check in with Secretary of the Commonwealth Bill Galvin, who oversees the state's elections. Good to have you back again, Secretary.
Glad to be with you. Actually, we've actually gone up close to 20% of the electorate now having voted. Process by which the ballots are received, it lags a little bit. That is to say, the recording of the acceptance lags a bit, a few hours or so. So we're up to almost 1 million so far.
Okay, so that is a fast rate of change, just in these last few hours.
Yes.
Is it going the way you thought it would?
Yes, very much. We felt that there was going to be a lot of enthusiasm for voting early in person. 4 years ago, we had 1 million persons do that, and representing roughly a third of our turnout that day. We knew that the introduction, as I had proposed early in the year, of extended early by mail was going to eat into that a bit. But we still sense that between the anxiety over COVID, which, needless to say, given the developments of recent days around here, is even greater, as well as the concerns about counting and receipt of ballots and some of the anxieties that have been promoted, in fact, by Trump, would contribute to a high turnout. Having said that, I also think we're going to have a high in-person turnout on November 3rd. The history of early voting has been primarily it's a suburban and elderly phenomena in the past, at least, and cities tend to vote more on Election Day. Minority communities, for instance, tend to vote more in person on Election Day. One of the reasons why I insisted on retaining a full 13 hours of voting was that it was important to make sure those options were there, especially for people who might have recently relocated, for whom voting by mail wouldn't be necessarily an option. I was joined in that insistence by the ACLU and the NAACP because they, too, recognize the importance of having the opportunity to vote in person as well. So between all of it, I think we're certainly on track for probably a record turnout.
And it sounds like you're saying you think we'll be up across sort of all methods of voting, in person early, mailing. All right, so let me ask you, are polling places, let's talk about in-person early voting. Mm-hmm. Do you just go to your usual polling place, or are there limited places, and how does somebody find out where to go?
Go to my official website. Or you might go to the website of your local community, but we have the complete statewide list. The hours vary and the days vary and the locations vary depending upon the size of the community. Most of the smaller communities are probably running it at their municipal offices. The larger communities are using other facilities. In fact, we encourage them to do that because, again, of COVID concerns. For instance, as you know, Boston began last weekend at Fenway Park. That was it for Fenway Park. But there are a number of neighborhood locations. Tonight is a night. I know there are multiple neighborhood locations. Other cities have maybe two or three locations, and larger towns also may have well relocated their premises where they're holding this to another building other than the municipal office building. So that's the best suggestion ever. If you go to my official website, you can look up Mass Early Vote. You can see where you can vote in person, and that will give you the hours and it will give you the location. In the community, you can vote. Any part of the community can vote at the early voting site. So, for instance, in Boston, as an example, you could vote at an East Boston early voting site, and even if you lived in Brighton, you still could cast a ballot.
So you can go anywhere as long as it's in
the city. You can go anywhere within the city and vote early, no matter where you are. That obviously is not the case on Election Day. That is November 3rd. You have to go to your local precinct on Election Day. But for this, you can go to any location and cast a ballot.
Okay, and just for listeners, www.sec.state.ma.us, right? The Secretary of State of Massachusetts. That's the website, and you can find your way to voting information from there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Great. Now, I don't mean to fangirl an election, but it is kind of exciting to see all these people turning out and to see people voting at places like Fenway Park. Does it inspire you? Are you inspired by what's going on?
Well, I'm inspired by the fact some people are turning out, not just here in Massachusetts, but throughout the country. Earlier today, I did a segment with Good Morning America, and I noted, you know, we've been refuting, and I've certainly been refuting, and other election administrators have been refuting the propaganda put out by Trump that it was fraudulent and voting by mail was defective. And the best evidence that that's not true is being delivered by the millions of voters around this country that have voted in person. They're refuting the deceit of that statement. The reality is people are very concerned about voting. The integrity of our electoral process is really what's at risk here because it's being attacked. And that's really one of the cornerstones of our country. And so I'm very inspired and delighted to see so many people making sure that they vote, and in some cases having to go through additional problems of standing in line or whatever it might be to make sure their vote gets in. So I'm very inspired by that.
And what advice are you giving to municipalities that are handling this huge early volume this year?
Well, we've been working very closely with them. In many respects, one of the most difficult aspects of what they had to do is mailing out all the early ballots. That was a real challenge. We had the experience of the September primary, which was helpful, even though it was challenging, because it gave them some ideas as to what they were going to confront. Obviously, the volume increased for the November election. So that's been probably a big portion of what they've had to do. As far as the early voting sites, once again, we've been providing them with assistance, PPE, plexiglass, other advice. The bigger spaces, the better, and that's the same thing we're saying for Election Day. Even if you don't move the building, if you are in the same building where you're going to hold voting, pick the biggest space within that building you can get. You need to space people out, not just for COVID, but because we're going to presumably have a very large crowd of people. And so I think it's extremely important that local officials do that, and I think for the most part they're trying to do that.
And that is Secretary of the Commonwealth Bill Galvin. We appreciate these regular check-ins you've been doing with us. Thanks.
Well, happy to be with you. Thank you.
And we will link to the Secretary of the Commonwealth's website on our website, radioboston.org. So we just heard from Secretary Galvin some advice he is giving to municipalities. Let's talk to a municipality and find out how it's going on the ground. We're turning to Jeff Nutting, who is helping cover administrative duties in Brookline while Town Clerk Patrick Ward is on medical leave. Jeff Nutting, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So what did you think of what we just heard from Secretary Galvin?
I have to say the Secretary and his team has been absolutely fantastic in supporting local clerks across the Commonwealth. We have weekly Zoom meetings. They've provided us with all kinds of information and PPE. So hats off to him and his team. They've been awesome.
And how do you feel like it's going, Jeff? Are you seeing the number of people you expected, more people than you expected? Are you feeling stable, overwhelmed? Give us a sense of it.
Sure. So this is what clerks live for. Election. We have about 38,000 voters. We've already mailed out almost 22,000 mail-in applications and absentee ballots. And through 3 days of early voting, we've taken in over 1,300 ballots. So the overwhelming part is just getting the ballots out and getting them back in process. But we have added about 12 folks to our team to help us do that. So we're ready and we're going to get it done.
All right, now let's talk about this back. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it's also exciting to see people in line. They just want to vote. And, I've been watching the door because, as the Secretary said, we relocated 4 voting places because they were in elderly housing, homes. And so people lining up the other day to vote, it was just they were so excited to come here and cast their ballot.
What were they saying to you, Jeff?
Probably, as a town clerk, we don't take position on who gets elected. So, but Brookline is heavily Democratic, so you can take it from there.
All right, fair enough. Listen, I want to ask, let's talk about these ballots that are coming in. When do they get counted and when do they get tallied? Because I think I understand that getting counted and being tallied are two different things. Is that correct?
Correct. We have 2 options this time. So we can remove the ballots prior to the election from the envelopes and then record all those and then have those fed through the ballot box on election day. That's option one. Or you can actually open them and count them before election day, but you can't record them until after 8 o'clock on November 3rd. So we will open all our ballots early, but we will send them to the polls. So each city and town has those options. And given our 20,000-plus, we could never do that on election day.
So you're not going to run them through the machine on election day. You're going to count them, but you're not going to register them until election day.
In Brookline. Other places, Brookline. I know Newton said they were going to count them prior to election, but the totals don't go through the voting machine until after 8 p.m.
Okay. So there's enough time to count. It's not like you're frantically counting, 30,000 ballots after 8 p.m. on election
night. No. So what we'll do on election day is, as the crowd ebbs and flow, we'll just feed our ballots into the ballot. We'll have two people just feeding the absentee and early ballots through the machines as people come and go on election day. So we did that for the primary. We had about 10,000 early ballots. Didn't have any problem whatsoever.
So, Jeff, you are covering the Brookline town clerk is on medical leave. I think you started at the beginning of the year.
Yes,
you can't have imagined that you were going to be overseeing elections during a pandemic. What has this been like for you?
It's been a lot of fun. It's democracy in action. It's a lot of stress, as the secretary said, but every challenge has an answer. So I've enjoyed every minute and proud of all our employees who've stepped up to the plate in the clerk's absence, who'd been here almost 30 years. And so we have a great team. It's fun.
Well, that is Jeff Nutting with the town of Brookline. Good luck to you and your team through the rest of this election season. And thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. Great to talk.
To say that Halloween in Salem, Massachusetts is a big deal is, well, it is a terrifying understatement. But this year, like everything else, it's also different. The mayor has urged people to stay away, and indoor haunted attractions are not allowed to open. For haunted house owners like Skip Dillon, that means a major loss of income. We caught up with Skip, the president of Wicked Amusements and the Chambers of Terror in Salem, as part of our ongoing series, Living Through Corona. And I asked him when he got the news that he wouldn't be able to open at all this year.
Much too late in the season, to be honest with you. We had been prepping for most of the summer for COVID protocols, assuming that we'd be opening our establishment under the recreation and amusement guidelines that the state had laid out earlier in the shutdown. Unfortunately, after expending a lot of time, money, and effort to make sure that we'd be able to open and still deliver a good show while also keeping guests and the employees safe, at about mid-September, September 15th, in fact, we found out that the state was classifying us as a live performance venue, and we would not be able to open, nor would any other indoor haunted attraction in Massachusetts. And as you can imagine, in Mass especially, finding out in mid-September that you're not going to be opening a attraction that makes all of its money in the 1 month of October came as a big shock to us.
So I wonder if I can imagine that. I mean, take me to that moment. What ran through your mind in that moment of shock?
Initially, there is that moment where you feel like the floor fell away. We have a small attraction. It does not generate a huge profit margin. It's a labor of love for myself and the other employees that make it happen each year for the tourists that come through Salem and want to have some scary fun. And so the financial numbers start pouring through your head of, is this going to bankrupt us? Is it going to bankrupt me because I'm personal guarantor on the lease? How are we going to maintain through to next year? Will we be able to recoup the loss? Can we recoup the loss and even, keep the doors open and the bills paid until the following season? But ultimately, I'm also a very objective guy, and I realize that the state and now the city of Salem itself are in a very difficult position in that they have to put the public health before everything else. And so that means trying to stop Salem, which normally has tens of thousands of visitors per day during the month of October from becoming a super spreader event, the likes of Sturgis or any of the other, you know, events that have occurred and that we've seen news coverage of during this COVID pandemic. And so while on a personal level, it certainly rocked my world a little bit, the objective, decent, socially minded person in me says, well, you know what? At the end of the day, it's only money, it's only credit, it's only business. And you levy that up against people's lives. Well, you know, there's no comparison there. The scales are always going to fall in favor of the lives of people and the health of the public.
You know, I appreciate that you were able to kind of keep that whole picture in your head. For a second, I want to note for listeners that Sturgis is the biker rally that happened in South Dakota and led to quite a bit of virus spread after the fact. So you're keeping all of this in your head, Skip, and you're trying to make sense of it. What happened when you had to tell your employees?
My employees, fortunately, are seasonal employees. At a haunted attraction, for the most part, nobody is banking on that seasonal income. And so it's more of an emotional reaction, similar to a theatrical, familial group of people that really take a great amount of pride and are emotionally committed to delivering a show each year. That's the rug that kind of got pulled out from underneath of them. But it looks like we're going to be able to do it next year. And so we'll stick around and we'll make it work, and everybody stays safe until then.
You had mentioned to one of our producers that there was some kind of sense of moral relief in not having the option to reopen, which kind of makes sense to me. Can you talk a little bit about that moral relief? And did it also have to do with fear about getting sick yourself, or your employees getting sick, or your customers getting sick?
I think that certainly the fact that every business, every public-facing business that's out there serves as a potential vector for contagion of this terrible disease always weighs in the back of the head of anybody that owns a retail operation. And so while we were preparing for what we assumed would be our opening this season, we were going above and beyond installing plexiglass barriers and getting atomized fog-style disinfectant machines put in and purchasing N95 masks for all the employees, and taking all these measures to reduce the likelihood of contagion, you always know in the back of your head that nothing is 100%. And even while driving into Salem during the late summer and seeing that there were still crowds in Salem, masked crowds of tourists and visitors wandering around, it was a strange place to be in mixed feelings and emotions for me, because on the one hand, that was giving me some financial and fiscal hope for what the season might do for us. But on the other hand, there's the question of why are all you people out here gathering in crowds when there's a pandemic going on? And do I really want to be potentially part of anyone getting sick, anyone spreading that illness, and in the worst and most tragic cases, somebody dying from that illness? And I have people who work for me in other ventures that have had family members pass from this. So as you said, the emotional relief of being told that you can't open that you know that 100%, I can turn and say, well, you know what? Nobody's going to get sick from my business this year, and nobody's going to, end up in a hospital or possibly pass because I needed to make my money. Is something that I cling to, and it makes me feel like I'm doing the right thing.
You said you're going to be able to bring it back next year. How are you going to pull that off? How are you making that work?
I'm not going to say by hook or by crook, because certainly not by crook, but I will live like a pauper for the next year and keep the rent paid. And the utilities running, and assuming that we're in a place where, you know, promising vaccines and therapeutics reach a point where people are able to go out somewhat unfettered. I think that next year you're going to have the pendulum swing back in the other direction, where everybody's going to want to get out and do as many activities as possible that they couldn't do in 2020. And I think that we'll have a banner year because of that.
Skip, I had kind of a sucker punch moment earlier today. In preparing to talk with you, I went back and listened to this wonderful conversation that we had on air with you and another guest almost exactly a year ago about why people want and need to be scared. And in listening to it today, you know, we're laughing and we're joking and we have no idea what's coming just a couple months later. And I got to thinking, as we were talking about why people like to be scared, is our relationship with fear going to change in some fundamental way now that we have lived through or are living through the kind of pandemic that used to only be in movies or haunted houses?
It's important to differentiate the type of fear that we're talking about. For entertainment purposes, fear is generally a startle, a quick dose of the unexpected, something to get your blood pumping and get your adrenaline to spike. And then you immediately have the rational part of your brain that takes over, that reminds you, hey, I'm not actually at risk. And with that comes that cathartic release where you laugh at yourself afterwards and you smile. And that stands in contrast to things that cause an actual fear and a dread of something that can really do damage or that could, you know, possibly harm you. And that's what we're dealing with right now. So do I think that people are not going to want those fun type of scares anymore? No, I don't believe that, because everybody's still watching horror movies in the midst of this pandemic. And, and for the haunted attractions that are allowed to be open right now, some of my cohorts up in New Hampshire, for example, and in other states, or outdoor attractions that have been allowed to be open in Massachusetts, the people are coming out in droves. So I question certainly the wisdom of any crowd event at this point in time, because I'm listening diligently to what the scientists and medical professionals are telling us. But the sociological take on it and psychological take is that I think that people will still want the entertaining type of fear. They're just getting really tired of being afraid of something that's invisible that is putting their lives in a tailspin.
You are a Halloween pro. Many people are mourning not being able to have a traditional Halloween this year. What is your advice for those people about how to still love the holiday this year?
Well, we're in a place and time where we have instantaneous access to more Halloween-related media than ever before. We also have the ability, certainly, to decorate our homes and our yards to a degree that didn't exist when I was growing up. I can tell you that if you had asked the 18-year-old version of me when I first got into building haunted attractions if there would ever be a time where you could go and purchase a 9-foot skeleton prop from Home Depot, I would have told you that you were out of your mind. So there are certainly a myriad number of socially responsible ways that people can still celebrate the holidays, and they can socially network remotely. They can spend time with their family in the home, and build their own little haunted nooks and attractions in their front yard, and stay safe until next year.
And that's Skip Dillon, president of Wicked Amusements and Chamber of Terror in Salem. Skip, thanks for sharing your story with us today.
Always. And happy Halloween!
We are going to talk now about a stewing controversy over how to fight the coronavirus pandemic. It emerged after a small group of scientists argued that the U.S. should pursue herd immunity. That is, let most people go back to normal, try to protect the most vulnerable, and ride this out until enough people have had the virus and are immune to it that the spread naturally stops. Those scientists signed their Great Barrington Declaration at a think tank meeting in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Some members of the Trump administration have embraced it. Now, backlash from other parts of the scientific community has been swift and harsh. Critics argue that a herd immunity approach is well outside the mainstream of science and would have a catastrophic death toll. Now, a quick reminder on the numbers. 220,000 Americans have died from the pandemic, with more than 8 million cases in the country. Scientific consensus is the virus is airborne, and currently there is no approved vaccine. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention gives the coronavirus an infection fatality rate of 0.65%, many times higher than that of the seasonal flu. We have two local voices for you now. One is a co-author of the Great Barrington Declaration, and one is a co-author of the John Snow Memorandum condemning it. We welcome first Martin Kulldorff, a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital. He is one of the three authors of the Great Barrington Declaration. Professor Martin Kulldorff, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So, your declaration has been widely criticized. I would say that in some circles it's been reviled. In penning it, did you anticipate the strength of the reaction to your argument? And if you did anticipate that, what made you decide to write it anyway?
I expected some reaction, yes. And the way we have handled the pandemic so far with lockdowns is the worst assault on the working class in half a century since the segregation and since the Vietnam War. What we are currently doing is we are protecting very low-risk college students and professionals like lawyers, bankers, journalists, and scientists who are at very, very low risk. And instead, the working class is building up the population immunity that will eventually protect all of us. And that includes high-risk older working class people who are in their 60s, who maybe are driving a cab, who work at a janitor, work in the supermarket, etc., and who have no choice but to work. So we are increasing the mortality with the current tactic. So what happens is with COVID-19, everybody can be infected, anybody. But there's more than a thousandfold difference in mortality between the oldest and the youngest. So among old people, COVID-19 is worse than the annual flu, considerably worse. So it's much more dangerous for them. On the other hand, for children, it's the opposite. For children, COVID-19 is much less dangerous than the annual flu.
So okay, I'm gonna stop you there because there's a lot in what you just said, and there are a few things I want to unpack before we go further into more information. The first part of what you said sounded like an ideological statement. You know, the worst assault on the working class since the Great Depression. I want to focus on a scientific discussion here in these next few minutes. So I want to start with this. Where you talked about we're building up immunity among the working class. Immunity, in fact, is in dispute in terms of the data with the coronavirus, is it not? I mean, we're not sure. We're seeing evidence that there are repeat cases. We're not sure how long that immunity lasts. Can't we question your fundamental principle that immunity is achievable in the way it would need to be for herd immunity to protect the population?
So first of all, if we don't have immunity from natural infection, then the hope for a vaccine is very, very slim. But there are a lot of people who've had COVID-19 so far since the start of this year, and we have seen only a handful of reinfections. So if there was not immunity to COVID-19, we would have seen many, many of those reinfections. So it's very clear that there is immunity to COVID-19. And
but is that really a binary? I really want to understand this. Is that a binary concept? There is immunity or there is not immunity? Or is this an issue of gradations? How immune are you? And for how long does that immunity hold?
Well, we don't know for how long it stays, for obvious reasons, because it's been around for less than a year. So for some diseases, we get lifelong immunity. For others, we don't. It eventually wanes. My guess is that we don't get lifelong immunity from COVID, but I don't know for sure, or nobody knows for sure.
Okay, then the other thing you said in those opening remarks was that there's a thousandfold higher mortality for certain portions of the population than for other portions of the population. It seems as if the argument in the Great Barrington Declaration is based in the concept that the appropriate metric is mortality. But I do want to ask, we have seen data that suggests, for example, that people who are otherwise healthy and maybe have light or no symptoms experience damage to their heart, damage to their lungs. And as you just said, we've had this virus or been aware of it for less than a year. How do we know that there aren't other serious lasting impacts of getting the virus, even if, I mean, that the morbidity part, even if mortality is not at issue?
So in terms of long-term effects, let's say half a year, there are cases of COVID-19 that leads to that, just like there is for annual influenza and many other infectious diseases. I have not seen any study that shows that it's more for after COVID-19 than after annual influenza. When it comes to long-term effects beyond a year, obviously we do not know anything about that. What we do know is that the lockdowns that we are implementing with school closures, et cetera, has led to a catastrophic collateral damage. Education is very important for school children, but not only that, we also have school, in-person schooling is important for physical health and for mental health. Cardiovascular disease outbreaks are much worse because of this, so people are dying from that. The childhood immunization rates have plummeted. Cancers are down, but that's not because people don't get cancers, because they're not detected. They are not the same cancer screenings. So somebody who might would have lived for maybe 15, 20 years might now die of cervical cancer maybe 3 or 4 years from now, because we don't do the screenings. And of course, the mental health is a catastrophe. And you will, and if you talk to a psychiatrist, for example, they will confirm that the burden on people have increased. And there was one survey from June that said that among young adults in their early 20s, 25% had been thinking about suicide, so suicidal ideation.
And
that's much
more
than normally. So there's enormous collateral damage.
Yeah, so you're making a trade-off argument there. Let's stay there for a minute. In the criticism of your argument, so for example, Dr. Anthony Fauci has said the idea could lead to, quote-unquote, an enormous death toll. And there have been a range of estimations in the criticism of the Great Barrington Declaration. On the high end, 1 million, maybe 5 million, conservative estimates in the 500,000 range. So are you arguing that that level of death, if we let this thing go among less vulnerable populations, is the appropriate trade-off for the other kinds of losses that we are experiencing that you just laid out? Is that the argument?
No, that's not the argument. The argument is that the focus protection plan that we are proposing in the Great Barrington Declaration is the way to minimize mortality from COVID-19. And there's basically three strategies that we could pursue with COVID. One is to do nothing or almost nothing. If we do that, then some old people will get infected and some young people will get infected. Among the young, there will be very little mortality. Among the old, there will be considerable mortality and we will have many deaths. So that is not a good strategy. It's a very, very bad strategy. Another option is to do general lockdowns across all ages, so everybody is protected equally. If we do that, we're pushing the pandemic forward in time, so we're reducing short-term mortality. but it will still catch up with us. And if we do protect everybody equally, then some old people will be infected and some young people will be infected. And again, since many old people are infected, we can have high mortality. So that's not a good strategy either. And that's the strategy we've been pursued now for over half a year. What we are proposing with focus protection is the older people and other high-risk group has to be much, much better protected. So that we have very few people among those who are infected. The young people can live their lives normally because they are at very, very low risk. So that is the way to reduce the overall mortality in the society.
So think of the massive disruption to lives that focus protection, should we be able to do it, that focus protection would require, so that people who are vulnerable, a significant percentage of the American population is at risk or high risk when it comes to implications or complications from the coronavirus. You talked at the beginning, and I know you have talked about the vulnerable populations that have been disproportionately affected by this virus, but they would also be disproportionately affected by or unable to do this kind of isolation. Have you seen this actually work anyway? Or it didn't work in Sweden, for example, where there was some attempt to it. I mean, in the nursing homes, it went badly.
So in Sweden, the problem for the nursing home was in Stockholm, which have a much higher mortality rate than the rest of Sweden, despite the same strategy. So in Stockholm, the nursing home was a catastrophe. It wasn't quite as bad as in Massachusetts or New York or New Jersey, but it was bad. So they didn't properly protect people in the nursing homes in Stockholm. And the rest of the Sweden, they did fine, but certainly not in Stockholm.
So for my last question, I do want to switch gears. You and your colleagues put this proposal forward through the American Institute for Economic Research in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. That is funded in part by Charles Koch. There have been accusations that there was a politicization because of that political funding. And the position has been adopted by people who are creating this framing, a binary framing politically of the lockdowners versus the herd immunity crowd. If you could go back and do it again, would you release this under auspices that were not so politically patinaed?
So of the three of us who who authored this declaration, myself, the world's preeminent infectious disease epidemiologist, Sunetra Gupta at Oxford University, as well as Dr. Jay Bhattacharya at Stanford University, none of us is taking any money from any pharmaceutical companies or any other large corporations, certainly not from the Koch brothers. None of us have received any funding, any stipends, honoraria, or salary from the institute where it was signed, nor from anybody else. We are all putting our own personal funds to be able to do this work. The institute had not seen this declaration before it was completed and signed. So, the idea about Koch brothers, that's nonsense. Actually, the Koch brothers has founded Neil Ferguson at Imperial College, who is a very pro-lockdown person, who was one of the initiators of proposing lockdowns. So to accuse us of getting funds from the Koch brothers is just abusive to do.
Well, no. I mean, either they funded the institute or they didn't. I mean, I think that's just a matter of fact. I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there. That's Martin Kulldorff, a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital, one of the co-authors of the Great Barrington Declaration. Professor Kulldorff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listening to that conversation was Dr. Rochelle Walensky. She's also a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, a practicing infectious disease physician at Massachusetts General Hospital and Brigham and Women's, and the chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Mass General. She's also a co-author of the John Snow Memorandum, which condemned this herd immunity approach and was originally published in The Lancet. Dr. Walensky, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I know you were listening just now, so my first question for you is there anything in particular that stood out to you in Martin Kulldorff's discussion with me just now?
What I want to say is he is correct in that he and his colleagues are deeply respected epidemiologists and experts. So I want to just give him a huge amount of credibility in that space. I want to acknowledge that I fundamentally agree that we need to protect our vulnerable people through this pandemic. I very much disagree on how that happens, and I don't think that the plan that he and his colleagues have put forward has ever had evidence that it worked. When I think about vulnerable communities, one of the things that I think about is the CDC data that suggests that, or when I think about vulnerable people, I think the CDC data suggests that about 47% of the American population has some sort of comorbidity that puts them at higher risk for poor outcomes with COVID-19. Those clearly are people that are going to have to be protected, but I don't exactly know how, given his plan.
Go ahead.
And then the other thing I want to say is about vulnerable communities, and that is people who live in multi-generational households who may not have the resources to properly quarantine. And also, in that space, I'm not exactly sure how we would protect them through this plan.
Have you seen examples of this kind of focused protection work either, other countries here in the United States at other times? Is this something that we know can work?
That's actually my biggest challenge with it, is I think that this is what Sweden tried to do. This was their plan. What we know from Sweden is that their death rate, their per capita death rate, is 591 per million. That rivals the United States at 593 per million. To give you a sense of what lockdowns were able to do in other countries, and I mean really strict lockdowns, in China, their death rate is 3 per million. So when you look at what Sweden was trying to do and what they are trying to emulate in Sweden, it didn't work. They were unable to protect them.
A term that's often used, by a lot of different disciplines is collateral damage. I want to use a little bit different term, which means other harm, I think is the term that I'll use. These lockdowns carry other harm. You heard Martin Kulldorff talk about some of that, mental health implications, economic implications. The CDC estimates that excess deaths is the term that gets used, have been almost 100,000 Americans. So what of that? Is there something, is there a trade-off in epidemiology where one starts to say that the cure is more painful than the disease? I don't want to sound glib here. I'm really asking.
Right. So there are two places I want to talk about with regard to that. One is the issue of mental health, and the other is the issue with the other diseases and collateral damage. So Dr. Kulldorff commented on higher rates of cardiovascular disease deaths, higher rates or lower rates of cancer screening that are then manifesting in more disease. There was a piece that was out last week that demonstrated actually the excess deaths that you're talking about between March and August in this country were about 250,000, 225,000. So, the challenge there is that only two-thirds of those were related to COVID. The other third of those excess deaths were likely related to either not accessing care or not being able to access care. And so that probably is, we did in our hospital system see lower rates of heart attacks, lower rates of strokes, concerningly lower rates of strokes because we knew they weren't coming to care. And so I believe that the fact that if we overwhelm our hospital systems, as could very well happen if we sort of let everybody, get to a herd immunity approach is being proposed, that we're going to overwhelm our health systems and we're going to see more of these excess deaths because people won't present. The other piece on the mental health I think is really important, and that is we do not know why people are having, we have many reasons why people are having mental health challenges. It's extraordinary what's happening right now. But many of those could be related to the fact that their loved ones have passed, that their loved ones have been sick, that they've had to say goodbye via a Zoom or a FaceTime. And that's really extraordinary times. They haven't been able to visit their loved ones in the hospital. So while I do agree that there probably are mental, there most definitely are mental health decrements by having our school closed, I don't necessarily agree that the answer is that we should, you know, get to a herd immunity approach and that these excess deaths will improve our nation's mental health situation.
You heard me ask Professor Kulldorff about this framing that is out there of the lockdown folks versus the herd immunity folks. And I want to acknowledge that that is a binary that doesn't exist and can be a problematic framing. I also want to say that we don't hear a lot of states, as numbers start to get worse again, we don't hear a lot of states talking about engaging in the type of lockdowns that we did necessarily in the spring when we were trying to flatten the curve. Are we going to need to, in absence of other approaches, are we going to need to go back to that level of lockdown? Or is the way Massachusetts, for example, is doing it in this kind of phased and targeted and frankly uncoordinated way, is that what we're likely to be continuing to do?
You know, I believe that the lockdown worked in terms of quote-unquote flattening the curve. We needed to do that in March. I mean, you saw the scenes of what was happening in our own hospitals in New York hospitals. That was not sustainable. I would like to think that we could get national leadership that would endorse a plan where people are wearing masks, where people are distancing, where we can have leadership that will allow for all of these things to occur and therefore can protect ourselves. I believe, actually, that the schools should be open preferentially over some of the things that are open right now. And I think we could safely get in a space to do that without having a full lockdown, because I understand the toll that that takes.
So there were signatories to the Great Barrington Declaration, and there was controversy there because some of them were clearly not verified or fake names. I know the John Snow Memorandum, which, by the way, is named after an epidemiologist, not a Game of Thrones character, had a lot of people who were scientifically verified also sign on to it. Is this back and forth healthy for the field, and will it get us to better public health outcomes? Or is this in some way, because of the politicization of this discussion, especially unhealthy for us? Which is it likely to turn out to have been?
You know, I don't think any of us went into this wanting to have a dialogue via, you know, signatories and memoranda. I think what happened was we were starting a group of us internationally, and in fact, at the same time the John Snow Memorandum came out, I also co-authored a piece in the Washington Post with colleagues at Yale, Greg Gonzalez, Mark Lipsitch at the Harvard School of Public Health, and Carlos Del Rio at Emory, because we understood that this was becoming part of an administration-endorsed policy. And we were very worried that if, that started taking shape, that the other side of the story would not be heard, and that there were certainly many of us who work in the field of public health and infectious diseases and epidemiology who very much believe that that was the wrong approach. And that was really our intent.
All right. Well, we are actually going to have to stop there. Dr. Rochelle Walensky is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, a practicing infectious disease physician at Massachusetts General Hospital and Brigham and Women's, and the chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Mass General, also a co-author of the John Snow Memorandum. Dr. Walensky, I appreciate you being on.
Thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, you can find links to both the Great Barrington Declaration and the John Snow Memorandum at our website, radioboston.org. And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening today, and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.